This is Senate Committee on Judiciary. This is May 9th, 1989, 5:30 p.m., Hearing Room 343. We have a public hearing on House Bill 2188, 2214, 2257, 2262, 2275, 2279, 2280, 2281, 2468, 3089, and 3195. We have a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2667 and a work session on House Bill 2273. 10-4.
We have House Bill 3195. Representative Campbell is here. And let's call Representative Campbell and company, I guess. Well, we'll take Gene when he gets here.
Okay. Thurman Smith, he may want to come up with me.
Thurman's from the State Grange, and Grace is here.
He doesn't want to be seen with me, so Thurman's going to wait.
Okay. Thurman can come up on his own. We'll invite him up on his own. Right.
You don't need to worry about that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Larry Campbell, 43rd District. I appreciate very much your courtesy of letting us lead off tonight. Before you is House Bill 3195, and what this bill does is will codify the current common law on adverse possession. Adverse possession is a land use concept whereby someone who occupies or uses someone else's land for a period of 10 or more years may acquire that land under certain circumstances. In addition to a 10-year time period, certain other elements have to be satisfied before the adverse possessor may acquire the land. These elements include actual possession, open and notorious possession, and constructive possession. Only after these and other smaller tests are met can adverse possession occur. The roots of adverse possession go back in history to a time when land surveying and deed recording were done more primitively than they are today. Back in these good old days, when there was a boundary dispute, it was most often settled by answering the question of who was occupying and using the land at that particular time. This way of settling boundary disputes came from early policy that promoted the utilization of the land as a high priority. However, in today's world of improved accuracy in land surveying and recording of deeds, there's more emphasis placed on the actual surveyed line than the old land utilization concept. You're late, Gene.
Sorry.
Under current common law, there is room for wide judicial interpretation of both the existence and or fulfillment of the many elements needed to prove adverse possession. Over the years, however, the courts have gradually moved toward making it easier for people to adversely possess land against honest landowners. And the bill in front of you, in addition to codifying the common law, also makes it perfectly clear to the judiciary that one of the main elements needed to prove adverse possession is that the adverse possessor has an honest belief that the property was his or hers and that they weren't trying to acquire property unscrupulously under the guise of the theory. There are a number of people from my district that have been affected by the gradual judicial loosening of protection for the honest landowner. This is the reason I've gotten involved in this, and I've been involved in it, as Senator Hill knows, for almost too long. And tonight I could have brought 20 or 25 people with me to testify, but I thought it might be worthwhile to give you one specific example in the essence of time. And so I've asked Grace Biggs from Vinita to join me, and she'll give you a real short version of her story, and it'll give you an idea of the kind of thing we're facing. So, Grace, if you would.
I'm Grace Biggs. My husband and I live on a small farm in the community of Crow, southwest of Eugene. I want to thank you for the opportunity to lend my support to HB 3195, establishing statutory criteria for adverse possession. Many people in Oregon whom I have contacted have suffered unjustly the loss or threat of loss of real property by being unaware of the common law, allowing them to be deprived of their rights by intimidation and threats of legal action. In our case, in 1982, we lost half an acre. The adjoining parcel lost 1 acre of timbered land from their 4 acres, and 2 other adjoining property owners lost less. We all felt so sure that our legal descriptions and recent survey, agreeing with at least 2 former ones, were correct and binding and would confirm our contention that we were the legal owners. In addition, our taxes were paid on a similar description of our property in the Lane County Assessor's Office. We were ignorant of the common law, and our lawyer was vague when we questioned him. Only on the very morning of our 2-day trial, several times scheduled and canceled, did he hand us copies of previous cases in which all defendants retained their properties. Though we did not understand the terms, these cases gave us hope. Our neighbor did not appear hostile, we thought. The plaintiffs claiming adverse possession knew the tricks and terms to use in court, and their witnesses were well rehearsed. Our lawyer advised us to just tell the truth, but simple truth was not enough. The fact was never mentioned that all our deeds agreed that the common boundary was a quarter section line running east from the established post as recorded in the assessor's office where we paid our taxes. No compensation was allowed us for our loss, contrary to the government's eminent domain payment for land. This statutory bill on adverse possession, HB 3195, will help to clarify the criteria over the present open-ended common law, which has subjected Oregon citizens to unreasonable expense and trauma in defending what should be their civil rights. Thank you for your attention in this matter.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes,
Senator Hill.
Ms. Biggs, could you give us a little more detail of how this all, just a little bit of how this happened?
The line that I mentioned, the quarter section line, ran east, north of our property, ran along east, and all the properties along there had that for the boundary in the description of their properties. There, at one time, this was a farm of about 20 acres, and it was divided into about 5 parcels. And the people on the there was a county road that ran along the quarter section line, but due to a hill being there back in the 20s, early 20s, when the people didn't have the kind of transportation they have now, they looped down across the property with the road so that they could go around that hill. So it looped down into our property. Everybody used that road. But when the road was vacated in 1929, these people on the north, their name was Sharon, they kept on using it, as did a lot of the people. And the people that owned the property where we lived, this 20 acres, didn't claim that property. They just let other people use that. And I imagine the reason was that they didn't have the money to move their fence back. And there had been a fence on each side of the road that the county had put in. And there's a description in the assessor's office.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, okay. It was this county road then that caused the problem.
Madam Chair, one of the things that we've had to work on this bill to put it in proper order is an agreement of a number of folks, and I have with me Gene Grant, who is the chairman of the Real Estate and Land Use Section of the Oregon State Bar, who would like to testify. We have finally reached an agreement, or I should say we reached agreement with the Oregon State Bar on this particular piece of legislation, and we're very pleased to have Gene here to testify.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Eugene Grant. I'm a partner in the Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt Law Firm and the current chair of the Real Estate and Land Use Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill, House Bill 3195, I believe would restore an element of basic fairness to the law of adverse possession in the state of Oregon. It's primarily aimed at correcting the result that was reached by the Supreme Court in the Nedry v. Morgan case. And Section 1 in particular deals with that, the result of that case. In that case, the Supreme Court made it clear that in Oregon, the element or the requirement of adverse possession that you have either a claim of right or color of title meant only that you intend to obtain ownership of the land, that it made no difference whether you were aware of and had knowledge of the true owner, that you could, in other words, you could be a mere trespasser or a mere squatter, but as long as you intend to obtain ownership by adverse possession, that's good enough. And that, in my mind, seems to really be contradictory to the very name of the element, claim of right, that you have a rightful, that you believe in your mind that you have an honest belief that you rightfully own the property. And other states have adopted similar statutes where there have been similar interpretations by the courts in those states. This has been a long standing split in the law in the different states, and it's in different depending on which state you're in. And one of the most respected legal commentators on the law of real property in his treatise said that the theory of the requirement of a claim of right is in part to bar mere squatters from the benefit of adverse possession, and in part to have in the claim a specification of the interest acquirable in this manner. So that's the purpose of Section 1. It explicitly includes the element of an honest belief that you're the owner of the property and that there is some objective basis for that belief to avoid this problem with trespassers.
Excuse me, Mr. Grant, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Springer.
So we've got to get into somebody's head, right?
That's right. And of course, you had to do that under the previous law as well. I mean, it's in either case, under the existing law or under the way this bill would change it, you have to get in their head. It's a question of when you get in their head, do they have to believe, have some kind of objective basis, and on that basis believe that they are the owner, or do they merely just have to intend or have the belief over the 10 years that they intend to obtain title to the property? So in either case, you're looking to their intent. All we're adding here is an element of good faith to avoid the bad faith type of situation with a squatter or a trespasser.
Okay.
The Section 2 of the bill would create a innocent trespasser defense. And the concept being that if we're going to make it a little more difficult to prove adverse possession than exists currently, we will provide on the other side some protection for the person who is the possessor. If he possesses innocently, then he ought to be protected against a claim for damages. Now, the Oregon Association of the Railroad Association has submitted some amendments to this Section 2, and those have been considered by the Real Estate and Land Use Section. We have a written amendment to give you. It would
it's a deletion, really.
On page 28, you would delete the word following, or line 28, I'm sorry.
Yes,
the first
say.
Page. Yeah. Not that many pages.
We're holding the other pages back until later.
That's right. We're going to submit the 28 pages.
Page 28.
Delete the word following on line 28, and then on the second, on the back side of the bill, delete lines 1 through 4, and the on line 5, delete the paren C and the word the. Now, we also, when I spoke with legal counsel for the association today, we also agreed that it would make sense to add an additional amendment that would, in the case of an innocent trespasser, prevent the owner from obtaining triple damages for timber trespass. In other words, cutting down timber and taking it off the property. They could recover the damages for the actual loss of timber, but the triple damage statute is a punitive type statute to punish somebody who intentionally steals timber. And if you have an innocent trespasser, it doesn't seem to make doesn't seem fair to assess them triple damages. And I believe that the legal counsel for the association has an amendment to that effect that will be submitted
that
tonight as well.
That will be presented by?
Who?
Mr. Marvin Fjordback.
Okay, great.
I believe.
Madam Chair?
Senator Springer.
Yeah, I'm sorry I got here a little bit late. Have we covered Mr. Grant or anyone who wants to respond? The requirement, I guess, that a person has to prove each of the elements that were putting in Section 1 by clear and convincing evidence?
I believe that's just a codification of the existing law of adverse possession because it is an equitable remedy. You have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence.
Same standard as fraud?
I believe so. My recollection is that you do, that on adverse possession, the existing law requires you to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. I can't cite you a case. I'm just working off my recollection, and it's been several years ago when I did the original research when we worked out the terminology in this bill, but I believe that that is just a codification of existing law.
We'll double-check that.
Oh, would appreciate we could.
Catherine, you got to take a note on that. Anything else, Senator Springer, for now?
The Section 3 of the bill deals with adverse possession in the situation of a co-tenancy. And there has already been a special statute on the books to deal with that. And in the Nedry v. Morgan case, the court interpreted that statute to not be an independent means of obtaining adverse possession, but required that a co-tenant prove all of the normal elements of adverse possession in addition to what's in the statute. And that is unduly restrictive in the opinion of the real estate and land use section of the bar, and we believe that in the situation of co-tenancy, it is very helpful to have this independent means of obtaining adverse possession where a co-tenant, if they exclusively occupy the property for 20 years, and meet the elements of the statute, then that is all they have to do to obtain adverse possession. Where this statute becomes very useful and most often is applicable is in the case of a property left by a decedent to a number of heirs under a will or through intestate succession, and where you cannot locate some of those heirs. They've disappeared. And so you have no means to find them and clear up the title in any fashion that is at all practical. The bill, as it is written, would allow the heir or heirs in possession, as long as they are there for 20 years, to obtain title to the property without having to try and find the other co-tenants and give them notice that they intend to obtain title to the property. And we believe that the extended time period of 20 years and the other elements required by that statute are certainly sufficient to protect any of the co-tenants that are not in possession. Thank you very much.
Senator Grinsky?
I'm going to be real brief. I just have a question that pops into my head on this thing. We have a little different standard for establishing adverse possession that, if this were to pass, would take effect on January 1 of 1990. Refresh my memory, if someone doesn't go into court and establish title, don't they still have an interest in real property? It just hasn't vested yet through the court's judgment. And I'm wondering if you're going to affect the ability of someone to obtain an interest in real property under a set of rules which would in effect be retroactive. They could have been there their 10 years. They just haven't
right.
gone into court to establish it.
That's right.
But this action or this statute would apply to those actions filed after January 1 of 1990. I wonder if that's constitutional.
That was discussed in the on the House side when this came up, and I believe that that provision, if I'm not mistaken, well, I guess that was in there. But that same question was raised. I don't know if they had anyone do any research on it. I didn't do any research on it. You're right in your analysis that to some extent it would be retroactive. In the sense that someone, if they've been on the property for 10 years and don't file, this bill would apply to them after 1990. I would expect that there may be some increase in filings prior to 1990 if this bill passes.
Real quick one. Are there any other states that have this? Is this a model of a uniform adverse possession code somewhere?
There's no uniform adverse possession act. We did look at other statutes that are on the books, and it is similar to those statutes. It's not exactly the same. It would be fairly unique to Oregon, but it in general concept of requiring that claim of right be based on a good faith belief in ownership, it's similar to statutes in several other states.
I guess I have one more little
Please,
quick one.
Go ahead.
Would you be interested in a legislative history establishing or reaffirming the case law in establishing each of these elements so that the courts aren't left dangling, wondering what, each of the elements, exclusive, hostile, continuous possession, is it your intention that the case law over the many, many years it's defined those things would continue?
That's a good point. Yes, it is. The intent here was to... as to the existing law, to codify it, and really it is intended that sections the subsections, all of section one is essentially intended to change only the result of Nedry v. Morgan with respect to the element of color of title or claim of right.
Well, there you go. You just established legislative history.
Good.
Thanks.
Senator Spurrier.
Mr. Grant, how often has the sort of inequity that's been described here, I guess by our civilian witness, occurred in your experience? I mean, we've all had constituents that feel that our legal system has done them an injustice. And
well, I can only give you anecdotal evidence. I don't have any kind of a study or survey. But I've since having worked on this bill over the last 5 years, virtually every lawyer that I've talked to, a real estate lawyer that deals with these kind of issues, has told me war stories of clients who have lost property where they sincerely felt that the person that took the property did know of the real ownership and were taking advantage of the law. Now, of course, that's not too surprising. It all depends on whose ox is being gored. But Representative Campbell has had a number of constituents who have come to him with these kind of complaints, and in the House Judiciary Committee, The representative for the Oregon Grange testified very strongly in favor of the bill, and for the reason that the chief victims of this kind of problem generally are farmers who who have large tracts of acreage and who are trying to be good neighbors and also don't necessarily have the money to keep up fence lines all around the perimeter of their property, and as a result end up losing part of their property out of, you know, they're trying to be nice to people and in fact are taken advantage of.
Madam Chair and Senator Springer, it was interesting when we got into this 2 years ago that a number of people stepped forward, not just from my area, but from all over the state who had had this problem. And people that stepped forward were both those who had won and who had lost in court. And I apologize for not bringing more witnesses tonight, but as I explained earlier, we have them available, and if it's appropriate, we can arrange to have them come in. But we brought Mrs. Biggs as one example of the number that we brought 2 years ago. This bill passed the House 2 years ago and did not have time to succeed getting through the Senate process. So,
I might just add, when I first started out, when I was first approached with this bill, in its initial form, it was written to do away effectively with adverse possession altogether, and I reacted like most real property lawyers would with,
that amendment, but...
Yeah. and my initial reaction was, this is, you know, what's going on here? And it's been a gradual process over the years of my conversations with other real estate lawyers and hearing the testimony that's occurred that I have become very strongly convinced that the that Nedry v. Morgan case result was incorrect and created real inequity that has hurt a significant number of people, and that result ought to be reversed.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you
very
much, Madam Chair.
Are there questions?
And Madam Chair, I do not have any objections to the recommended amendments that have been suggested.
I have written testimony.
We appreciate it. Thanks.
Should I give that to someone now?
Yes, please. Let's go ahead and call Thurman Smith. Thurman, please go ahead.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Thurman Smith from Lyons, Oregon, and I'm representing the Oregon State Grange. The Grange supports House Bill 3195. The present situation is that faith in people and ignorance of adverse possession laws have proved too costly to too many people. It appears that adverse possessors depart from the presumption that the land has been abandoned to them and proceed to construct a basis that will ripen into title regardless of the facts. Let's say the courts do the best they can with what they have to go on, but in the absence of clear, concise statute, courts must develop concepts and interpretations. In the realm of adverse possession, confusion in the minds of ordinary people has been increased by the language of the court. Some examples are the kind of occupancy or use of the land which will satisfy the requirement will vary with the nature of the land. A different yardstick is used in different situations. The test applied is what use would an average owner make of the property, taking into account the geophysical nature of the land. Possession without hostility will not ripen into title. However, hostility is not used with the ordinary dictionary meaning of ill will, but the intention of claiming exclusive title and a denial of title in anyone else. The requirement of continuity does not require actual possession every single day of the period of limitation. Even if no evidence of hostile intent exists, there is a presumption of hostile possession where the property is used in a manner that the owner would use it. two men, I am a realtor, and two men have come to my real estate office within the last couple of years, attempted to commit me to secrecy, and finally told me what their problem was. They wanted some advice from me on how they could adverse somebody and get a piece of property for nothing. I sort of looked at them. I says, what about the moral wrong and the technical right here? But that posed no problem for them. It made no difference. All they wanted was to know the method so they could get the piece of property for nothing. Mr. Average Citizen, who bought, paid for, and just got title to real property, cannot always discern the facts which form the basis for a cause of action. And we cannot properly allege that they knew or should have known. We must have legislation to improve this situation. And it is definitely in the best interest of the public that you pass House Bill 3195.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks very much for coming. Everett Cutter.
Important aspects of law enforcement.
Thank you. Steve.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Anderson, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I would simply want to put us on record as in favor of this bill. I would characterize it as a housekeeping, money-saving measure, and if it will help unclog the system and perhaps move things along faster, seems like a good idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, did the District Attorneys Association take a position on this bill?
I don't think officially they have. We have had district attorneys, individuals, say that they have no problem with this. In fact, many district attorneys I practice in the Yamhill County area, for instance, some in Polk County, Washington County. Many of the prosecutors already do this. I don't think it's really asking for much of a change. It's just simply to make it uniform throughout the state.
So they do not oppose it?
I'm not aware of any strong any opposition to this from the individuals I've spoken with. I don't know about the association.
John, what was the vote out of the House?
I don't know that. Maybe
Jack can probably look up. No,
I have the committee vote, Madam Chair. It was 12-0. I don't have the floor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Senator Springer?
Should we consider expanding this to those jurisdictions where we've got a fairly active municipal court, require the city attorney to review citations before they are filed in municipal court? Eugene and Salem have pretty active municipal courts. I mean, I realize indigent defense is their problem in that situation, but did you folks give that any thought?
We didn't really, our committee did not consider that, I believe probably because the funding from the state is different for municipal courts than for the district or circuit courts.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, both of you. There's no one else signed up. Let's move then to House Bill 2262. Oh, you are the same. I better look ahead here. Something else.
I thought you'd gotten rid of us. But
right.
Again, John Pinkstaff for the Oregon State Bar Committee. This is simply a situation where for a charge's failure to appear, a lawyer who is called to testify as a witness cannot thereafter represent the defendant, and a new appointed attorney is required to be appointed by the court. This is costly to the indigent defense system. Normally, notice of appearances can be given by the court. There's other adequate means for proving this element of the case, and whether where the court in this case determines that no other reasonably adequate means exist to present evidence establishing the materiality of the charge, well then it can be that lawyer can be called as a witness. So we think this is a good bill, and will save the indigent defense system a significant amount of money.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Anderson with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We endorse the bill with one caveat. We believe that it recognizes the importance of the constitutional right to counsel, the attorney-client privilege, and ethical considerations that all attorneys have to maintain confidences and secrets of their client, as well as the Oregon State Bar disciplinary rules. However, this last sentence, I understand, was added on the phrase, unless the court hearing the matter determines that no other reasonably adequate means exist to present evidence establishing the material elements of the charge, would seem to run somewhat counter to that thrust. And I guess to put it succinctly, we could endorse it more enthusiastically if that phrase was removed. And I understand that, well, I'm not sure what the proponents or position.
As I understand it, that language was added in the House, or at least when I was testifying in the House, they considered the some situations that may be necessary, and so I believe it was at the request of the district attorneys that that last language was added. Our committee really hasn't taken a position on it. I think, personally, I think I would concur that it doesn't, it could be a rule that would take, or an exception which would consume the rule, and that's my concern with it.
So you don't have, you'd just soon leave it off?
That's correct, yes.
From your point of view. Okay. Committee needs to, Senator Baker?
Well, I just, looking at it, just, an astounding thing. Right, as I read it.
You know what? Never mind.
Lawyer testifying against his client on the material elements of the charge which he brought into the court.
Senator Shoemaker,
this got through the House.
They compel lawyers to do that in criminal cases now.
Well, we'll have that before us in work session, and the committee can take a look at that last sentence. And we've heard the testimony. Steve, you made a...
I would simply, Madam Chairman and Senator Shoemaker, I would be happy to submit some kind of response to Senator Shoemaker's concerns, if that would be appropriate, prior to the work session.
I don't think it's necessary. I think Mr. Morris can bring me up
Thank
to
you.
Speed on... Certainly an unwarranted assumption about attorney-client.
Okay, thank you. Let's move to another one of Jack's, House Bill 2468, the Medicaid fraud. Related to Medicaid fraud.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Janine Robin from Oregon Department of Justice, Director of the Medicaid Fraud Unit. Oregon has a criminal Medicaid fraud statute, which was enacted before anyone was prosecuting Medicaid fraud in Oregon. It's quite a good statute, but it would be more useful if two other laws were amended, as I'm proposing to you, through House Bill 2468. One is the Oregon venue provision to clearly give Medicaid fraud cases venue in a central location. The other is the Oregon criminal RICO statute to include the criminal Medicaid fraud statute submitting a wrongful claim for payment in the present list of RICO crimes. Medicaid fraud as committed by submitting fraudulent multiple billing claims is exactly the kind of crime that the RICO statute was enacted to include. It doesn't include this statute, and I'm asking you to amend it to so include it. Does anyone have any questions?
Now, you're asking amendments, further amendments, or you're just testifying to the bill as an amendment?
I'm testifying to the bill. There is a proposed amendment to the bill as it came out of the House, and that's not a substantive change. It's to include an additional statute number. The Medicaid fraud statute has one number and then a separate statute number that actually makes it a crime. When it came out of the House in one part of the bill, they only included one of the two necessary statute numbers. So on page three.
Okay, it's in the back here. Your,
right,
your proposed
page four
amendment.
Of my testimony packet. Great. Is the proposed amendment to the House bill as written.
Are there questions?
Take that just an oversight.
Yes.
Senator Grinsky wants to look at the relating clause to see whether we can give RICO to the county.
No,
Senator
no.
Springer would object to that.
That did cross my mind fleetingly.
Right.
And I'm not going to do that.
Are there questions for Janine? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mason, this is a good bill. Good bill. Okay, Catherine. Where's Catherine?
I think we ought to.
Yeah, we'll go first. Yeah. Yeah, 2273.
I
got some amendments.
Go ahead, you have my permission.
Don't have it.
I got 2273. This will be in. This will be.
Yeah, we'll
see. We'll go right on.
Got a bill.
Go long on this.
2273. Relating to civil process. So, Catherine, would you get organized here? I can't even find the right bill here.
This is the retirement.
Oh, yes. And we have someone to explain the bill to us.
Yes. Craig Edwards is here from the.
No, that's my bill.
Here. Craig Smith.
Craig Smith. From Eugene. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Tell us about 2273.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, let me give you just a little snippet of history here that this bill has passed the House and was brought before this committee several weeks ago. I wasn't aware of the scheduling for hearings, so did not testify at that point. You did receive testimony from representatives from the Pension Exemption Subcommittee of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section. By the way, by way of introduction, my name is Craig Smith. I'm from Eugene. I'm a lawyer with the Hirschner Hunter Law Firm with a practice area substantially devoted to pension plans. I'm also on the Executive Committee of the Business Section of the Bar, and it's in that capacity that I present the bill to you today. So with that background, I've not had an opportunity to explain, I guess, the reason I drafted the bill and an amendment that you have before you. And I can go one of two ways. One is to give you my reasons for the bill, and the other is to assume that you know that and then go on to the amendment.
I'm not sure how many people were here for the original hearing. Why don't you just go briefly through the reasons for the bill, and we can go from there.
Thank you. The ORS 23.170 has been around for quite a while, and in 1987 there was an amendment passed which had the effect of broadening the statute to include some newfangled pension plans, one of which was a 401k plan, another was a 401c plan, which was commonly referred to as a KEO plan, and the third was individual retirement accounts, and that legislation did pass. When I saw the legislation after the 87 session, it occurred to me that, without throwing stones, that it could have been clearer. in draftsmanship. And so the purpose of this legislation is really to clarify what I perceive to be the policy intent associated with the 1987 legislation. And the major policy considerations that I saw there are, one, that there was an intention to protect pension benefits that were provided by owners of small businesses, small unincorporated businesses, and secondly, to allow individuals to provide for their own retirement either through an IRA vehicle or a 401k vehicle and have those assets protected from creditors as well. And that is the scope of my clarification. Another element of the 1987 legislation that I was concerned about was the what I would call the anti-stuffing provision. And what it provided was that if money went into one of these qualified plans within a year of a creditor claim, that it would be subject to the claim. The concern I had there was really technically from a pension lawyer's perspective, and that is that the way the cases developed, it didn't matter whether the result of the invasion of that fund was disqualification of the entire plan or not. It seemed to me a rather severe sanction to disqualify an entire retirement program because one participant had his or her interest attached by a creditor. In the meantime, at the federal level, and of course at the state level as well, the amount of money that can go into retirement plans has substantially been reduced because of tightening up at the federal tax system. And so my conclusion in the drafting this is to say that as long as you make a contribution to a plan, either an individual retirement account or some sort of qualified plan, that is within the constraints of the Internal Revenue Code and the state of Oregon's tax system, that's okay, and that is not abusive. Again, the result of that and an overriding concern from my perspective is to maintain the sanctity of qualified plans and not to create severe adverse tax consequences for everybody, not just for the one participant who had his interest attached. That gives you the background for the bill. The amendment is a result of some discussions between myself and the members of the Pension Exemption Subcommittee of the Debtor Credit Section to reconcile our different views. And the first element of that was simply to add some language to the general exemption provisions on page 2, line 12, that addressed an issue of concern to both the debtor-creditor section and certainly to myself of recent preemption cases in the handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court and interpreted very recently by some bankruptcy courts. And the purpose of the amendment is to state that it is the policy of the state of Oregon that pension plans, or as I use the term retirement plan, which is a defined term in the statute, are spendthrift trusts, even if they're self-settled. And by self-settled, I would use as an illustration an individual retirement account, which is would technically be a self-settled spendthrift trust under this statute. And the reason for that has to do with bankruptcy law and the way the bankruptcy law works. When pension benefits are the subject of a bankruptcy, the initial and threshold question is whether or not that asset comes into the estate of the bankrupt. The analysis the courts use in making that determination is whether or not the asset is part of a valid spendthrift trust under the applicable state law. And so what we're trying to do with this is simply say it doesn't even get in the framework of a bankruptcy estate. It's within the context of the bankruptcy estate. Once it comes in, you get into issues of preemption. Simply the cases are not yet decided about the extent of the recent Supreme Court case about preemption in this area, as it applies to pension benefits in a bankruptcy estate, and I could go into that in a little more detail if you want, but I'll open up for questions at this point.
So the summary is we've included every legitimate
everything I can think of
that you can think of.
That's right, including benefits for state employees, kind of qualified deferred compensation plan, annuity plans for educational institutions.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a question. Does this represent a change in the bar's position? Because I remember starting with some piecemeal pieces on my part in as early as 83, 85 on some things that people were requests for exemptions, and we did some, and the bar said, well, let's not do it this way, let's wait, and we're going to study it, and so they waited, and we did something in 85, and we did something in 87, and now you're here with a sort of more comprehensive sort of piece.
I cannot represent to you that I know. I am aware of the background for the 1987 legislation, and that was really the impetus of one lawyer from the Dalles, as opposed to a bar position.
Right. There was another lawyer from wherever that I was working with on the same issue, and we could get together, but okay. There have been individual lawyers in 85 and 87 who have looked at it, and it's never been able to come to consensus until now, I gather.
Right. To my knowledge, this is the first time the bar, well, some or committee within the bar has taken a position on it. And it would appear as if we reconciled at least the pension exemption committee and of the debtor creditor section with the legislation as I've drafted it. So.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Appreciate your work on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's move into 3089. Mm-hmm. Does the committee want to adopt these amendments, I guess, and vote on this? But we've had a hearing before. It would be it is up posted for a work session today, so we could dispense with this if people are comfortable with it.
No problem.
They have a problem.
I'm ready to go.
Okay. Senator Springer moves the amendments.
Amendments.
2273-2. Are there objections?
Just a question. Did we deal with why they jumped from 5,000 to 7,500? I mean, that's a pretty small jump, and we're amending a bill that passed the House.
Okay, I would suggest that this section has not been in the House. You want to come back up and?
Sorry, but I should have caught that earlier. But it just looks like such a small little thing to amend it at this point of the procedure. I guess I'm just a little bit.
Well, the whole section is new. The whole section is new.
Yeah, that's not.
And I don't know what else it's.
Well, no, but that's the only.
Well, there are two pieces. I've seen two pieces of paper and some one. But there are two amendments here potentially. At least one is the spendthrift trust language, which I feel very strongly about. And then the second one is really one that first appeared in another bill, and what we were trying to do is just reconcile all of the bills that related to this topic with this amendment. And so it's not a very significant one in my mind, except for the clarification. The dollar amount is a big deal, but the clarification is important because the change here, let me explain first what this is about. If money comes out of a qualified plan and some other place to do, at least a qualified plan, and is deposited into a bank account before it's spent, there's a possibility for an attachment by a creditor. And what this does is say, if it's deposited in a bank, it's exempt. What we've tried to do here is simply say any account, money market accounts, whatever. Yeah, and that's important, I think. The $7,500 is just kind of a cost of living adjustment that was in another bill and seemed reasonable to me. I had not addressed that in my initial legislation.
Okay.
Okay. We have objections to Senator Springer's amendments. So are
the bill as amended to pass.
Okay. Senator Springer moves House Bill 2273 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair, could I just ask a question? Was anything asked about staff measure analysis? It says as funds transferred to a pension plan with the intent to defraud could be reached regardless of how long the funds have been in the pension account.
I think the change was that originally the existing law is that anything that was put in within the last year wouldn't be protected. They extended the protection to all funds, whether they were put in with the last year or not, and said, in order to protect against fraudulent transfers, we'll then open the whole account to fraudulent transfer, to the Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Okay.
It's just they redid it.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Aye.
Wait a minute.
Senator Gretzky?
What are we doing?
Voting.
Voting do pass House Bill 23.
Don't leave the room.
House the amendment has been already accepted.
Yeah.
Okay.
House Bill 2273, and it's my fault, Senator Gretzky, I should have repeated the motion. Senator Springer's moving House Bill 2273 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Pat.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, now let's move to 3089. Oh, we're done with that. No, bonds and probate proceedings.
Well, I'll tell you why.
Who's here on 3089? I don't have a sign up sheet on 3089. Do we have a sign up sheet on 3089? Well, short of that, let's just start the list down. Got so many sign-ups here that we've got more. Oh, Tracy Meyer is here, representative of Stan Bond. Yes, I'm sorry, the sign-up sheet got lost. 3089, Tracy Meyer is here. Representative Stan Bond's assistant.
Senator Cohen and members of the committee, my name is Tracy Meyer. I'm a legislative assistant for State Representative Stan Bunn, and I'm here to testify on his behalf on House Bill 3089. This bill deals with the issue of a bond when an estate goes into probate. Under current law, when a person dies, an executor of an estate is appointed, and that person must post a bond. This is an assurance to all the heirs and devisees that the executor will not use the funds inappropriately. The bond also acts as security that the executor will perform his or her duties in regards to the estate. There are cases when all the heirs are family or close friends. Often it is the case that the heirs do not feel the executor would abuse their position. Therefore, a bond need not be posted. However, under current law, a bond must be posted. In years past, this has not been a problem. However, what has happened in recent years is the bond premiums have gone up. The amount of a bond is determined by the value of the estate. The formula says that you must pay $20 for every $1,000 up to a $50,000 estate. After you pay $4 for every $1,000 of the estate over the $50,000 mark. What this comes down to is this. An executor of the estate worth $50,000 would have to post a $2,500 bond. This is an unneeded cost when all the involved parties agree that a bond is not necessary. There may be rare cases in which the heirs feel a bond is not necessary, but the judge believes it is. House Bill 3089 does contain language on line 23, which would allow a court, in its discretion, to require a bond be posted. It should be noted that the Oregon State Bar expressed some interest in the bill when it went through the House. However, after speaking to representatives from the bar, It was decided that the bar would not take a position on the House bill. It is for these reasons, the case when all parties feel a bond is not necessary, the fact that posting a bond can be great and unnecessary expense, and the fact that the bill contains a safeguard allowing the court to intervene, the representative, Stan Bunn, agrees urges the committee to pass House Bill 3089 onto the full Senate. Thank you.
Thank you.
This isn't a question because I don't know that the witness would know the answer to it, but when it refers to all devisees and heirs agree in writing, that could be quite a burden if it's an intestate estate. You might not even know who all the heirs are, or some of the heirs may be in foreign lands. And I think it could make...
And you probably ought to go ahead and post the bond.
Well, except that's pretty expensive. I mean, some heirs may be... The chances of their taking are pretty remote. And I wonder if we shouldn't give the court discretion to not require the agreement from all heirs. If in a court's judgment, it's not practical to obtain that permission, and he doesn't think it's a significant risk.
Well, I suggest you talk to the sponsor about that and see what they're willing to do. I suppose the Oregon State Bar stepped away from this because they thought it didn't do that much, didn't step away that far from current practice. So I guess that we'd have to ask the question of Representative Bunn and have him go back and visit again with the bar to find out what it would mean.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker and the committee, I try to answer questions, but I'm not really familiar with this as I'm reading it into the record.
Oh, I understood that.
I could find out or have the representative speak with you if that'd
okay,
be preferable.
Maybe you have him ask me about it.
Yeah, I'm frankly one wouldn't want to move too far away from the requirement of a bond just on the face of it. But I'm happy to have people look at it and see if you wanted it moved in that.
Well, I think it's a good bill. I just think that maybe they built something into it that is going to make it hard to use in case it should be available.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll note that.
I'm going to excuse myself.
Okay, we have 20. Let's get to the...
We have
some questions still. Craig Edwards is here from the debtor creditor section, and Gene Grant is here from the real estate section. And I guess Gene. For the moment, we're talking about 2279 and 20.